Good morning. You've tuned in to North Idaho News of the Week. It is Friday, March 13th. I'm Jack Peterson. I'm here this morning with Chris Bessler. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Jack. How are you doing?
I'm doing just fine.
Are you doing a little snowy? Perhaps feeling a little snowy.
It is. Yes, it is a little snowy. At last, actually, a little bit of winter finally came our way this week. One of my headlines is actually that we are still in a snow drought, though. It's an unprecedented fourth straight year with below normal snowpack and drought conditions, according to the Natural Resources Conservation Service.
Does it say how much we're below this year?
Oh, it the article does, but I think we're well below. This is
it's lower than a couple of the previous years, I'm sure.
Yeah, this little bit of snow we're getting right now is most welcome. Also in the room with us this morning, Jack Freeman, who covers the city of Sandpoint and education beat here for the Bonner County Daily Beat. Good morning, Jack.
Good morning, Jack.
And
is that an echo I hear? Yeah.
Let's get right to the headlines. A lot going on down at the state level. More than we could fill up the full half hour easily with just talking about what's going on in Boise, but I'll hit a couple of the headlines that caught my eye. The short-term rental bill passed the Senate and now heads to Governor Little's desk for signature. It was originally House Bill 583, and it passed the Senate 23-12. It previously cleared the House 54-16. From Legislative District 1, where we sit, Cornell Razor voted in favor of this measure. Mark Stouter opposed it. And then in the Senate, Jim Woodward opposed it. This bill drastically reduces the powers of counties and cities to regulate short-term rentals. Sandpoint and other communities in the state with significant tourism sectors are expected to be particularly affected. Mayor of Sandpoint, Jeremy Grimm, opposes the measure. And he said in a statement to the Sandpoint Reader, with the passage of House Bill 583, Idaho has taken a significant step away from one of the state's longstanding principles, local control over land use and neighborhood planning. It's headed to the governor's desk, and I haven't read anything suggesting that he's not going to sign it into law. So probably this will go into effect later on this year. And that'll more or less do away with all that work that the Planning and Zoning Commission did in the fall and into winter and spring of this year for the city of Sandpoint, trying to bring their own regulate the short-term rentals and bring them into line with current existing state law. But we'll discuss that more, I'm sure, and see what folks expect to see from that law. Chris, you just talked to the Selkirk Association of Realtors. Yes. And this came up on Wednesday, I'm guessing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And you can hear that podcast on our website, KFY.org, if you want to visit that and hear what they had to say about that and some other issues as well, of course.
Yeah. House Bill 659 passed 41-27 and heads to the Senate. That bill requires all local law enforcement to enter agreements with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. That's ICE. Pursuant to the federal 287G program. For our legislative district, Mark Sauter voted against and Cornell Razor voted in favor. Our sheriff here, Daryl Wheeler, has been vocally opposed to this measure as well. And it's divisive.
Based on loss of local control, I think.
Yeah. Divisive to the law enforcement community as a whole, I think, as well as Wheeler, Sandpoint Police Chief Corey Kuhn had made statements against it. And again, Mayor Jeremy Grimm had a negative view of that bill as well. The Health and Human Services maintenance budget failed to pass the Senate, and that is the first budget bill of the session to be sent back to the committee. Jim Guthrie from McCammon, a Republican from McCammon, seems to have made a persuasive speech yesterday that called the budget situation a defining moment in time, and the bill was expected to pass, but after his words, it went down rather dramatically. And now they're going to reassess the Health and Human Services budget.
So you're saying oratory matters?
In this case, it seems like it did. Yeah, I'm kind of reading between the lines there, just because in his statement, he mentioned that he was expecting the bill to pass, mm-hmm. and by the end of his statement, the votes had changed to go the other way. I mentioned already we are in a fourth straight year well below normal snowpack up here in the Idaho Panhandle. How about some county news? In Bonner County, after an hour-long executive session, the Bonner County Commissioners voted Tuesday to hire Stacy McBrayer as fair manager at the Bonner County Fairgrounds. McBrayer has been on the fair board. She was appointed to the fair board on May 6th for a four-year term, later elected to serve as that board's treasurer. She will now be required to step down from the board and if she should accept the manager's position. But I believe she's expected to. So new manager at the county fair. And here in the city of Sandpoint, the city is going to roll out their new parking system by this summer. There's a new page on sandpointidaho.gov that features a map and further details on what the new system will be. And we can talk more about what that system will be exactly in a little bit if we have time to get to it. But I think probably the big headlines this week are in the education, from the education desk, which you fill so nicely, Jack Freeman. For one thing, Jalen Peters, who is the school board, was the school board representative from District 5.
Zone 2.
That's exactly what I meant to say. Zone 2. Jalen Peters from Zone 2 has resigned from the school board and is moving out of the area. So that seat is now officially vacant as of March 10th. The board will accept applications and will fill that seat by June 8th. And it was a full house at the most recent meeting of the LPOSD board. The community here, I'll read your words here, Jack. Students, alumni, and supporters of Lake Pendre High School packed the district's meeting rooms Tuesday to express frustration about the decision to move the school to portables behind Sandpoint Middle School in 2027. Let's talk about it.
All right.
Okay.
Let's do it.
The meeting was well attended, you say?
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
I think news broke about this earlier this month, I think, that it was going to, that they were planning to close the school altogether, Lake Pendre High School, the alternative school. And
that's in the old Lincoln School on Boyer.
And the plan would be then to move those students to the portables behind the middle school, and that has drawn significant community response. And that how would you characterize that response, Jack?
How would I characterize it? I mean, I feel what we're seeing right now is a lot of frustration and sadness. I believe the news broke in the Sandpoint Reader. They kind of confirmed the rumors, and when I talked to people about it, it just felt very sudden for a lot of alumni and even students who are going to school who maybe didn't know what was happening. Maybe they were graduating senior and stuff like that. And so what I've gotten from a lot of my conversations, I had an interview where I talked to 16 students and alumni. They all packed into the Daily Beast conference room, and I spoke to them. And this is a school that has an immense impact on these kids, even as they grow up and become adults. You know, that experience stays with them. And so to hear that where they had that experience is going away has definitely generated a really emotional and hurt reaction from the community, at least from what I can tell.
Mm-hmm. And is this primarily just a budget decision?
More or less, yes. Yeah.
It is the I'm assuming it's an old, very old building, and the upkeep is probably, you know, inordinate compared to a newer building. But has there been any movement from the board in reaction to the reactions they're getting from people that support that school?
Not that I'm aware of right now. I don't even believe this was a board decision. You know, this is, I think, maybe why the reaction was so emotional, is that it was primarily a district decision, where they were just like, hey, you know, the school is running, I believe it ran at around a $340,000 deficit last year. The enrollment is shrinking. It's going to be, next year, it's projected to be about half of what it was 2 or 3 years ago. And so this was a district decision. The school board just kind of has to decide what to do with the property. So I think that's kind of where the input will come in the community. But so far, I haven't heard anything from the board that would suggest that they're planning to reverse course. They even talked a little bit about how they feel it's actually a success that LPO has a shrinking enrollment, because that means less students are falling through the cracks at Sandpoint High School. Mm-hmm. And so they're, you know, trying to look at the positives and work with that as they move forward.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And of course, the emotional reaction is, for a lot of those kids, they would have dropped out, mm-hmm, if they didn't have the Lake Pondre alternative school.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It really got their life back on track. I've heard 25 or 30 people just in the last few days tell almost an identical story, which means that program is working. Mm-hmm. And it's unfortunate to see it shift away from where these people have kind of found another home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess it's the, as Meyer says in your piece here, she's quoted, I am by no means recommending that we shut the program down or just integrate those students into SHS. She goes on, I'm trying to find the spot where we're being fiscally conservative and responsible with taxpayer dollars while still supporting the at-risk alternative school program. So, yeah, nobody, it seems like there's no advocacy to try to altogether close the program. But moving it out of that building and back onto the campus with the high school and the middle school, I imagine a lot of the students who go to this school are going to it specifically kind of to get away from a troubling or troubled history at Sandpoint High School. So I don't know. It does seem like there's you're going to lose a little bit of the draw of that high school.
A lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do they plan to use the building for?
That's a board decision. So I believe they had a schedule in the last board meeting, but I believe in April or maybe May, they're going to go out. They have to get an appraisal on the building by state law. And so they'll go out and they'll do that. And then we'll see what they choose to do with it from there once they have that in hand. There wasn't any discussion of that in the board meeting, really. Only the chair, Lonnie Williams, really spoke about this issue and basically said that he understands the change is hard and that they're going to try to do what's best for the district. So what that means, I'm not really sure. I think the community will have to be vocal in what they want and keep showing up the way that they did to make sure that, you know, maybe if they don't want this building sold, that it doesn't get sold.
Mm-hmm. It was a district decision, as you said. It wasn't made by, there was no vote by the school board. Is it possible, though, with the kind of outpouring of public support for, it seems generally to keep the Lake Pondre High School open and in its current building, is it possible for the board to reverse course on this? What would it take to reverse course?
Yeah, when I talked to Superintendent Dr. Becky Meyer, she really told me, you know, the first question out of my mouth was, is this final? And she was like, yes, this is a final decision. We have to do what's right for the kids. There just isn't enough money coming into the school because of the way that Idaho funds schools. It's really based on enrollment. And when you have a shrinking enrollment, and on top of that, you know, you're working with these kids to just get them to show up every day, it can be difficult. And so I think with a lot of community support, I think we could maybe see that conversation reopened, but I heavily doubt that the community would be able to come up with, we're talking probably over $1 million to really move the needle if the enrollment does continue decreasing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wonder if they could combine other programs, though, into that building. If the, you know, a chunk of the building is not being used because of a decreasing enrollment, they could use it for Homeschool Academy or some other things like that that they...
Well, the Homeschool Academy was there, and it got moved to Clark Fork recently, Clark Fork High School. So we'll see kind of what they end up doing with it. Maybe the community support can change course. I wouldn't say, you know, never say never on these things, but I'd say it looks highly unlikely. They've already sent staff out to where the portables will be, the LPO staff, principals, and stuff like that to get an idea of, hey, this is what you're going to be working with. What do you guys think? So it seems like the plan is already more in motion than, I guess, not.
I mean, Chris, you asked this and you already, we spoke about it, but it seems like, I mean, if they're not going to have a school there, they're probably moving towards selling the building or what, renting it out, I suppose, or something like that, you would think.
Yeah, we'll see what ends up happening. I know that the building isn't in the best shape. That was part of the reason behind the decision. You know, it's an older building. The upkeep costs are more. Maybe the community could gather around and get that place deemed a historic building in a way. That could be a way to save it from being torn down or maybe even sold. But I think we'll need to see what that appraisal comes back as and if the district even deems it worth it to try and sell it.
They'll have to maintain it if it's still on the books, even if there's no school there. So you'd think they're going to have to find some way to maintain that building. I don't know. I guess, you know, what I was kind of thinking about here is that the population of the area is growing. I would expect that we're going to see increasing enrollment in the district, not at that specific school, but in the coming years and decades, and to lose an existing school building 20 years down the line, they might think, boy, would have been nice to have to have one extra school in town. But
yeah, and then knows? and they might choose to keep the building or the land, because, you know, with people moving here, that land's only going to get more valuable. I think the chair mentioned that before, and that can be looked at as valuable and they're going to sell it and make all this money, or valuable as in we need to keep that asset. And so I'd need to have more conversations with the board and really see how that's looking to say anything concretely. But I think that appraisal will really tell us a little bit more about where the board is looking to go when they discuss that in, I believe, May.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
We've kind of been down this road in a fashion when the community was unhappy about selling the old ninth grade center, which is the building that's on Euclid. It was actually the Sandpoint High School originally. And then I think after the high school moved, it became a facility for, they called it the ninth grade center. And that sat unused, kind of semi-condemned, you know, it needed a lot of work. Until an entrepreneur bought it and then renovated it. And it's, I don't know if you've been in there, Jack, but at one time it had a gym in it. And I actually played volleyball and basketball in that gym way, way long ago. And it has a beautiful auditorium in it as well. It's like this one, you know, school and total school in one spot. But, it, you know, it kind of was an example that you take a building that was the district felt not usable anymore, and it was able to be fixed up. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know how the finances are on that. Sometimes it's cheaper just to build a new building than to try to fix something up. But I think it's on the it's a National Historic Register building now too, built in the 1920s, I think. So, yeah, it's sad to see these old buildings we have affection for, but it's a tough question. Like, what's the best course here?
Yeah, there's no good answer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm curious to hear about parking stuff.
We better get into it. Yes, we haven't talked enough about parking yet in 2026. I don't think. 2025 was the year of parking, and now we'll let's get into it. The new plan passed. I believe it was on March 5th. I'll have to pull up your article here and confirm that. But the new plan passed the city council vote 3-2. And it will now go into effect. And that effect will be what, in your words, Jack? What are we expecting to see coming to downtown and elsewhere as far as paid parking goes?
Well, kiosks will probably be the main difference that people will see. There'll be kiosks placed about downtown, I believe, around 43. Just to clarify, the actual parking plan passed last year in June. This is the management plan.
Oh, right.
So this is just how we implement it, or the city is choosing to implement it.
The IPS group.
Yes.
They approved.
It's a contractor that they're going to use to put up the kiosk. Do they also manage it too, manage the system?
I believe that they do, yes. Yeah. They have their own proprietary system that the city will be using. And so that's kind of what people will see at the start, I guess, when it's implemented. They'll see kiosks placed downtown in the along First and Second Avenue, and then in the City Beach lot, the city lot over here. That will more or less begin the paid parking adventure for the city. There's been a lot of confusion for, you know, parking passes, time limits, things like that. But from my understanding, the parking on First and Second Avenue will remain free for the first 2 hours, and then you can buy more if you need more time. And you'll always have to be registering your session with these kiosks, either via app or they also have a text option as well, or you can just go up to the kiosks. And it's all tied to your license plate, basically. So the parking pass is tied to your license plate. These kiosks are going to be tied to your license plate, kind of a thing. I've got to get that in my head by summertime, definitely.
Except if you can still park and not mess with a kiosk if you stay under 2 hours on First and...
Well, you could still get a ticket. You could still get a ticket.
Even if you're parking for less than 2 hours?
You would need to start your session.
Oh, really?
So okay. You need to start your session. That was a question that I believe Joel asked at the meeting. And again, I mean, you could ignore the kiosk altogether, but you're just risking getting a ticket the same way that you are when you park over 2 hours now.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. How do they know when you... Okay, so you go, you register your session, you're there for an hour and a half. Is there like a checking out you need to do? So... there's probably things you don't know about this system yet.
That I'm not aware of a checking out feature. I believe that you just get it for 2 hours for free and then you can just leave. But that is a really good question.
They'll have an enforcement officer that is able to look and say, okay, these guys started 2 hours ago. They've been here for, 2 hours and 10 minutes. Ticket time. Yeah.
Yeah, could be. Something like that. I think that's more so. Just you check in, so you start your 2 hours, and then there will be an enforcement officer who could say, oh, these people are a half hour over, or these people are an hour over, kind of a thing. And that's only in the on-street lots. In the off-street lots, that will be paid parking. I believe at City Beach and in the lot over here on Church, those will be paid parking. That'll be hourly. That hourly rate isn't set yet. That'll be set by the city council in a future meeting. But city residents and county residents can pay their passes to park there. It's a yearly charge, and they can park there for 8 hours a day.
Okay. And the passes for a city resident is just $15 for a year, right?
Yeah, for city.
If you're not a city resident, anybody could buy a non-resident pass for $30 a year. So that's as I understand.
I believe it's a county resident for
only
$30
county
a year.
Can buy a $30 a year pass.
Yes.
And I've seen the question pop up on social media because there's been a lot of social media talk about this. Why do the poor county people have to pay twice as much as the city people.
Well, it's a city. It's a city thing. You know, it's.
Well, I mean, I think it boils down to that the city residents are already paying property taxes, right?
Yeah.
So city residents are already contributing to the city infrastructure.
Exactly. Yeah.
And county residents aren't. Yeah.
And I've got my correspondent, Jason Welker, here. He's letting me know a couple of things. You don't have to check out. So the kiosks, and he's talked about this a couple of times, but just kind of is to give the enforcement officers that real time data to find the people who are going over. Right. Okay. That was one thing that the downtown business owners from that meeting back last summer, they were like, why can't you just increase enforcement? And this is their way of finding enforcement because they can't read license plates. It's illegal under Idaho state law.
Right.
So this is a way, if you give your license plate, then they can just check that. They don't have to chalk tires or do anything like that, which would take far more time from the enforcement officers. And then as well, the time limits are still staying just 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. So that 8-hour passes. A virtually all day pass. Right.
Okay.
So if you're going to go out to dinner after five, you don't have to worry about, registering at the kiosks and staying for so long, in a way.
Okay. And that's another question that came up. The people that do have the pass and can pass, park for 8 hours if they work in town, that should cover their whole working day.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, there you go. Yeah. That'll be convenient for those of us who work downtown. Okay.
And of course, you know, there's, the city's produced a map. Actually, the city also has an interesting, video you can watch.
Mm-hmm.
They do. Is that available from their homepage, you know, or?
I believe it's on there. Yeah. It's on their YouTube channel is where I found it.
We put it up on our Sandpoint Online Facebook page. It explains not only how the parking is going to work, but the rationale behind it. The people that have watched it seem to kind of get swayed a little bit by, you know, the rationale part of it, I'd say.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think when you look at this parking plan, I mean, this seems to be a fairly good compromise from what I think people were thinking of when they think about paid parking is that it's only hourly everywhere and, you know, you're back to the meters that can really rack up a lot of pay. It seems like the city staff worked to make a lot of options. I just think people hear paid parking and immediately they're like, nope, not doing it. Don't want to hear about it at all. So when they do hear about it, I think it can kind of change their mind a little bit because they see the options. And it looks like it is on the Sandpoint website at sandpointidaho.gov/parking.
Yeah, it's actually pretty tough to find. I mean, I've been seeing some reactionary folks saying, I'm never going downtown again. you know, I'll go to Coeur d'Alene. Well, I think you got to pay in Coeur d'Alene.
You do got to pay in Coeur d'Alene. I was just down there. Yeah, I was like, man, $2 an hour and everywhere? Come on.
Yeah. So when do you know the timeline on this, when it's actually going to go into effect?
Yes, I believe Jason said that they're targeting that 4th of July area to have it all up and running. There's going to be more public education about this as we kind of move forward. So that date might shift a little bit. We'll see kind of where they decide. But I believe that summer, right when, you know, City Beach is at its most full, is when they're going to try and implement that.
Okay. Yeah. A bit of a sea change, but the other thing to remember is that we've had paid parking in the downtown. There are pictures of parking meters up and down First Avenue from, I think, the 60s. So the folks that that are newer to town probably don't remember that.
I
think they took them down in the 90s, maybe something like that, when they actually removed them from First Avenue. Let's see. Our time is short. In fact, we've gone over. But Chris, I need to ask you about the prop that you brought in today. You have
it's a prop for tonight. But yeah. The Panda is showing the movie Train Dreams, and it was a book first, as most good movies are. And it was by a fellow named Dennis Johnson. And this is a guy that flew so under the radar. People didn't even know he lived around here. He had about 100 acres up on the Moyer River, Train Dreams is actually set along the Moye River, the book. Mm. It's not as discernible, I think, in the movie. But this book was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in 2011, I think it was. And Dennis Johnson also won the National Book Award for one of his novels, The Tree of Smoke. He was a major literary author in our country, well-respected in the literary services back in New York. And it's just fascinating to me that we had this author here who nobody knows about.
Yeah.
Wrote some outstanding novels. And so after the movie tonight, we're going to have a discussion on the stage. I knew Dennis Johnson just a little bit, more of an acquaintance than a friend, I'd say. But a good family friend, Barb Rawlings, is going to come down and tell us a bit more about Dennis and how the book was conceived. It's loaded with history from the late 1800s to up through the early 1900s, and it's amazing how the historical facts that I've checked in this thing are actually accurate. Mm-hmm. I mean, little factoids that you see in the book is like, Elvis Presley was in Troy, Montana, and yeah, he was in Troy, Montana in 1957, yeah. And that's just one of the little vignettes out of the book. And we're going to also have Jack Nisbet, who is a well-respected author of local history. He's written Sources of the River and a bunch of other books. Is going to be on stage to talk about. He was involved somewhat in helping set the historical parameters for the movie, mm-hmm. the filming of the movie. And as well, we're going to have Kootenai Elder. Eileen Wheaton is going to be on stage to talk about how the Native Americans are portrayed both in the book and in the film. There's very little in the film. There's more about the Kootenays specifically in the book. Of course, the book's set right there. Mm-hmm. And I talked with her, and she's actually said she's read that book 8 times because she loves it so much. Mm. But I look at some of the ways that the Native Americans are portrayed in the book, and I wonder how she feels about that.
Yeah.
So it'll be an interesting conversation after the movie tonight. The movie's at 7 p.m. There are tickets. You can probably get them right at the door. You could go online to panda.org and get those.
And it's nominated for several Academy Awards.
Four Academy Awards, including Best Picture. It's not getting nearly the amount of talk that a couple of the other films are, so I'd say it's a real dark horse to get that particular thing. But there's some cinematography awards that it's up for. But that just getting nominated tells you it's really a well-done movie.
Yeah.
Hey, before we leave, I want to throw out one thing. Today is the last day to file if you want to run for office in Bonner County. And I was just checking who's filed up to this point. You have till 5 p.m. if anybody's out there thinking about running for office. We have 2 people that have filed so far for County Commissioner in Zone 1, Fred Arn and Steve Smith. Interestingly, the incumbent there hasn't yet filed. The incumbent, Asia Williams, has filed for her seat in the second zone, as well as Jeff Roberts. These are all Republicans because they'll be facing each other in the primary. Roger Rudd and Spencer Hutchings have filed for Bonner County Clerk. And interestingly, Mike Rosedale is not there yet. So we'll see if he gets on board. And then for County Treasurer, County Assessor, and County Coroner, so far the incumbents don't have anybody filing against them. So just thought I'd throw that out there, and we will, of course, I'm sure next week be talking about who wound up filing for office in Bonner County in these for the May 19 primary election that's coming up.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Yeah, deadline today. Don't miss it. And we'll be back next week talking more about it. Thanks, Jack, very much for coming and sitting in with us this morning.
Thank you for having me on.
And time now for Otto's Eclectic Mix, all day long here on 88.5 KRFY.